I think the numerical growth of the church is something that we all desire. But I'd like to give us some things to think about this evening, because we have to make sure that we think biblically. Just like we do in other matters, we have to especially make sure we do it on this matter, because sometimes our obsession with growth can be so strong that we might be tempted to go outside biblical bounds and then teach or embrace things that we normally would not do. First of all, let's talk about doing the extraordinary. Or really, I wish that the acceptable pronunciation of that word was not extraordinary. I wish it was extraordinary. Because I think when I pronounce it that way to myself, it helps me to understand exactly what that word means. We're talking about doing stuff that is beyond the ordinary. Stuff that is more than the world expects. Doing the extraordinary. What am I doing that is beyond the ordinary? Why should people listen to me rather than someone else? Well, someone says, well, Don, you've got the truth. And if they'd read the Bible, then they'd know that they should listen to you. Well, everybody makes that claim. I don't know of anybody in any field, not just in the church, but let's just talk about the churches. Is there any church that says, well, don't listen to us because we don't preach the truth? We promote falsehood here. Or how about automakers? Don't buy from us because we make pieces of junk. Go to the next guy. No, everybody says they've got the best, or they've got the only thing that we all need. But let's go with the cars thing. Okay, I listen to their claims, but I want them to prove to me. I want them to demonstrate that I should purchase from them and not from someone else. And the same thing goes with people listening to me as a Christian. What am I doing that is extraordinary? What do I do to get people's attention? How have I made myself credible? Would you listen to you? Are you doing something that would make you want to listen to you? What are we doing together that is extraordinary? Same questions that I just asked before. In other words, why should people listen to us rather than some other group? Again, I don't mean because we've got the truth and someone else doesn't. Because that's what we might say. Well, if people would read their Bibles and listen to us, they'd see that that's why they should listen to us. But again, everyone makes that particular claim. What do we do together to get people's attention? If you lived in our community, what have you, along with the other members of this congregation, done to attract your attention? Do we work together or against each other? Do we have a spirit of cooperation with one another that the world sees and they say, hey, I don't see that in the world. I see contention out in the world. But I like what I see there. I want to be part of that. Is that what we get across? In Matthew 5, I believe Jesus taught what is really the spirit that changed the world, especially the Roman world, and then from there it's gone clear to our day today, that changed the world in Christ's favor. There's just some things that he said here that have always impressed me with the nature of Christianity. And when you study church history, you'll find out that what is said here is really something that went on in the early centuries, and the world noticed what is said here, practiced by the early church. Matthew 5, 38 through 42. Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. See, the world doesn't expect that. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with them two. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Is there anything that shows that we go the second mile? Though the world expects you to go the first mile, and the world itself goes the first mile. But what about me? What about us? Are we going beyond that? Going the second mile means to do more than asked or expected. What are we doing more than what the world does or expects? If we only do what the world expects or what the world itself does, why should the world become part of us? I mean, we're just like the world then. We're worldly. So there must be something different about us. And again, Jesus addressed this right there in Matthew 5, verses 46 and 47. He said this, "For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not the tax collectors do so?" So we've got to be different, not just for the sake of being different, but because we want the Spirit of Christ. Are we turning the world upside down? Why or how, as we'll find in Acts 17, did the church turn the world upside down? And they really did. The world has never been the same after Jesus came here and then after the church went into action. In every nation where it's gone in the past 1900 years. In Acts chapter 17, the Bible records an accusation that was made against the early church. Now listen to what it said starting at verse 5. "But the Jews who were not persuaded becoming envious, took some of the evil men from the marketplace and gathering a mob, set all the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason and sought to bring them out to the people. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, 'These who have turned the world upside down have come here too.'" We've heard about this movement. And we've seen how they've disrupted other parts of the Roman Empire. And now they've come to our city. What are we going to do about this? We need to stop these people by whatever means it takes. And if you know history, secular history or Christian history, doesn't matter. If you know history, you know that the Roman Empire did what they thought was necessary to stop the church, including killing our brethren centuries ago in some of the most brutal and horrible ways. But here's the thing. These people saw the church as a threat. Secularists in America see the church as a threat, and that's why they are working night and day to silence religion in America. But my question is, does anyone see the Savage Street Church as a threat? How does our community view us? When we do things as a church, does the devil tremble? I think it was last year that I saw a quotation, and I don't remember where I saw it or who originated it. But someone was saying, "I want to so live that when I wake up in the morning and my feet hit the floor, Satan says, 'Oh no, he's awake.'" And I thought to myself, that's what I want the devil to do with me. I want him to think that he's just been having a good old time until I wake up in the morning and now I'm his trouble. And he's got to deal with me. I want him to tremble when dawn rolls awake. But I also want him to tremble when the Savage Street Church is awake and alive and working. Does he see us as such a threat that he has to take drastic measures to stop us? Let us so work together that that will be true of us. Now let me talk about previous generations in relation to church growth for a moment. As I've already kind of indicated or hinted at, I'm fascinated by church history. Because I read about how Christians, and of course I focus in on the preachers, how they lived. And I think to myself, Don, you're not even close to that yet, but I'm striving for it. You know, we hear about St. Patrick. Well, if we can just remove the saint from that, and if you can study about him, you will be amazed as to how this man lived. And how, there's even a book out, I believe it's called How the Irish Saved Civilization. And I want to get it because I've heard about it. And it talks about how really what he did with the Irish and then how the Irish ended up saving Western civilization in particular ways. Because this man was so influential. Well, how did he do that? How did Paul do what he did to affect the entire Mediterranean world almost single-handedly? When I was in Northern Ireland back in 2002, and Brother Steve Lloyd and I, we stayed at a bed and breakfast inn, and then from there we'd go out and do our missionary work. And as we ate breakfast every morning, there was... we were sitting like next to a bookcase. I noticed some really old books, and one set of books was by a man by the name of John Donne. I think it is D-O-N-N-E. And I would look at it every day, and finally the lady who ran the place said, "Hey, you can have that book," and it's in my office now. And I just would read how this preacher fought and the poems that he read, and I was just so impressed with it. Maybe you've heard the name Alexander Campbell. Maybe Walter Scott and some others. Have you ever read how these men lived? They so saturated their lives with spirituality, the scriptures, and especially God's will, that it just naturally flowed out of everything that they did. Have you read Fox's Book of Martyrs? If you never have, you need to read it. Perhaps you've heard of it before. Wow, the things those people suffered. You don't do so by just being a half-baked Christian. Let me tell you something else that I do that I'd encourage you to do. For those of you that can get on the internet, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, when I come into my office here, every one of those days I go to ChristianHistoryTimeline.com. Christian History Timeline.com. And you'll see a link there where you can click on the story for the day, and then it opens up into a new window, and it's not very long because I don't have a whole lot of time to read something that's long. And I think, wow, this is amazing. No wonder the church grew in past centuries. You also see a timeline across the top where you can click just different time periods in history and get more stories. It's just fascinating. They put everything in the context of God's will because that's what they saw biblical people doing. Now, I'm going to give you a bunch of scriptures right now. Those of you who have the handouts, you can see them all. So I'm going to give these to you in machine gun fashion, just boom, 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 and then we'll move on. So if you don't, if you can't open to your Bible fast enough, then I can give these to you later or they'll be on the handouts, okay? Here's what 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 19 says about David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hand." David inquired of the Lord, "I've got a plan, but shall I do this?" Then in chapter 15, verse 25, he said, "Then the king said to Zadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. Psalm 37, verse 5. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will bring it to pass. Psalm 121, verse 8. The Lord shall preserve your going out and your coming in from this time forth and even forevermore. The Lord's the one who preserves your way. Proverbs 19, verse 21. There are many plans in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the Lord's counsel, that will stand. Acts 18, verse 21, Paul speaking. And as he's leaving some brethren, he said, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem, but I will return again to you, God willing. Acts 19, verse 21. Again, Paul speaking, or Luke writes about Paul, that says he purposed in the Spirit that when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia to go to Jerusalem, he said, after I've been there, I must see Rome also. Romans 1 and verse 10, Paul told the Roman Christians, he made request that by some means, now at last, I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. It's all about God's will in my travels and in my work, he said. Romans 15, verse 32. Paul prayed that I may come to you with joy by the will of God. 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 19. But I will come to you shortly if the Lord wills. 1 Corinthians 16, 7. For I do not wish to see you now on the way, but I hope to stay a while with you if the Lord permits. Hebrews 6 and verse 3. And this we will do if God permits. And then the last one, you're probably familiar with this one, James 4 and verse 15. Instead, he says, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. And of course, in that case, he's rebuking some early Christians because they were saying, okay, we're going to go into this city and that city and conduct business. And they just left the Lord out of the equation. So it's not just talking about preachers that should be talking this way and making their plans. It's everyone, business people, everyone. It's about God's will. And that's one reason why the early church exploded in growth, because they thought that way. Now, let's understand growth for a moment. I read a book shortly after I started working here that was not about church growth. In fact, it wasn't even about the church at all. It was about business. And some of the things it said did not apply to the church at all. But some of the things that this book said did apply to the church. I want you to consider just the title of this book, which the authors meant in reference to businesses, but I want to make a reference to the church. Here's the cover of the book. It's not the big that eat the small. It's the fast that eat the slow. When I saw that, I don't remember where I bought it now, but when I saw that, I thought that really attracted my attention, because I could see an application for the church there. And so I just made some more applications from them. It's not the big churches that eat the small churches. It's the fast churches that eat the slow churches. The ones who are with it, who get things done. It's not the instrumental churches that eat the a cappella churches. It's the churches that have passionate singing, as opposed to that eat the churches that have the performance or performer audience concept. And you know something? I'm going to give just my opinion, okay? So if you want to continue to use this particular language, that's fine. That's with you. But not, I'm not going to. And I have never done it, as far as I know. I don't like us to talk about this as the audience. You're not the audience. You're the congregation. Because when we talk about that, it's like whoever is up here is the performer. And you're the audience. And we better do a good job. And if we don't, then we won't like you. That's not what it's about. And so when we come into our singing, we're not necessarily looking for someone to perform for us. We need to be singing. Every one of us needs to sing with passion. And that's what will convert people. The early church was a cappella, and look what they did. Somehow. It's not the fancy buildings that eat the plain building. It's the loving people inside who eat the churches that don't care about people. I really believe that there are multitudes of people, even here in our community, who just are looking for genuine Christianity. And they just want someone to love them. Because they go some places, some churches, and people just don't really care about them. The early church did not have buildings. Isn't that true? Jesus taught in the temple. He also taught in synagogues. But he also taught and met with people on mountaintops, on mountainsides, next to a lake, in a boat in the lake, walking down the road, and so on. He attracted people in other ways. It's not the rich churches that eat the poor churches. It's the sacrificing churches that eat the stingy churches. I know of many poor churches that far outdo the rich churches. It's not the fun that eat the boring. It's the spiritual that eat the materialistic. That's where our emphasis should be, on the spirit and being spiritual. Now, let's discard some bad thinking. When it comes to the size of churches, I've heard so many times things like this: large churches must be liberal. And of course, that's meant in a bad way. And that small churches must be sound. Large congregations must be doing something right, and small congregations must be doing something wrong. Concerning growing churches, same thing. We'll say that, well, growing churches must be liberal. You know, someone in a congregation might say, well, we're not growing, and we know we're sound, so if you're growing, you must be liberal. Non-growing churches, they will then conclude, are following the Bible. Some people will say, well, a growing church must be doing something right, and the non-growing churches must be doing something wrong. But as I'll show you in a moment, all those things are not biblical. We shouldn't think that way. And on emphasis. Sometimes we'll say that growth depends totally upon us. It's all about us. And hence, if we're not growing, it's our fault. But we leave out two important parties in church growth: God and the world. See, there's three parties involved. There's us. We have a work to do. The world, of course, has to respond. And then there's God, who gives the increase. Sometimes we believe that if we have the right programs in place, then we'll grow. Or we'll think that we shouldn't learn what other congregations or churches are doing, or that church growth depends solely upon what the preachers and shepherds do. But brethren, now let me ask you some questions. How many people did Noah convert with his preaching? I don't know how long he preached. For some reason, I've often assumed that he preached from the time that God decided to destroy the world with a flood and until the time happened, and that was 120 years. But he may have been preaching for decades or hundreds of years before that. He saved himself and his wife, his three sons, and their wives. Was he a failure? Did he do something wrong? Hopefully, we would not say that. Or some people might say, well, that definitely is a sign that he was a sound and faithful preacher, because nobody would respond to his preaching. How many people followed Jesus? Sometimes the biblical record will not say that a multitude followed him. But listen to the way Matthew 4 states how many people were following him, okay? Now, I don't always know what the biblical writers meant by multitude, but listen to Matthew 4:23. Great multitudes. I love both of those words. Not just a multitude, and not just multitudes, but great multitudes followed him from Galilee and from Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. Well, I guess Jesus was a liberal. Look at all the people he attracted. That's what some people would say. He was a false teacher. So we go from the extreme of Noah to the extreme of Jesus. But the numbers don't tell us everything. And don't tell us whether the preacher was successful or not. How many people responded on the day of Pentecost? Well, about 3,000 souls, Luke writes, gladly received Peter's words and submitted to baptism. And if that happened here, let's say something happens tomorrow, and Nathan and I are at a large gathering, and for some reason we get the chance to preach, and 3,000 people respond. Would we think, well, what did those guys do wrong? Or what did they do right that they weren't doing right before? How would we think that? How many people did Paul gain with his preaching in Athens? Quite different than the day of Pentecost. Listen to Acts 17, and listen to the way Luke records the numerical response to Paul's preaching in Athens. Verses 32 through 34. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, while others said, "We will hear you again on this matter." So Paul departed from among them. However, some men joined him and believed. Among them, Dionysius the Areopagite, a woman named Demarius, and others with them. It's almost as though Luke was saying, you could count them on one or two hands, the amount of people that responded to Paul's preaching there in Athens. And so far as I know, in the rest of Acts and in the rest of the New Testament, there are no references to the church in Athens. Well, did Paul fail? Did he do something wrong? How many people initially followed Jesus in John 6? Well, verse 10 indicates that 5,000 men, so excluding women and children, 5,000 men were following him. And he does some preaching to those people, and they're offended by it, and Jesus himself whittled down the numbers to, now get this, verse 67, to where the Bible says everyone left him, and then he turns to the 12. From 5,000 men to 12 men. And then later, one of them turned his back on him and betrayed him. Interesting. Here's what I'm just trying to say is we can't judge things by numbers. We've got to be really careful about that. We can't judge a church by its numerical size. We can't judge an evangelistic work, whether it was successful or not, by how many numbers resulted from it, and so on. We've got to be very, very careful about that. Concerning obsession with numerical growth, I believe 1 Corinthians chapter 3 implies that we should not be obsessed with numerical growth, remembering that God is the one who gives the increase. Did you hear what Caleb read earlier? 1 Corinthians 3, verse 6, Paul said, "I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase." God gave the increase. Yes, we want to see numbers, but we have to keep in mind that one soul is worth more than the entire world. And I believe that if only one soul had sinned, I think Jesus still would have come and died. And I base that on Galatians 2:20, where Paul personalizes the crucifixion of Christ. He loved me and gave himself up for me, Paul said. Therefore, if we focus on just one soul, showing that one person that he is worth more to us than the entire world, we'll communicate to that something to that person. And he'll communicate it to his family, friends, and other acquaintances. And before you know it, we'll have an army of evangelists. Others will notice how we treated that one soul. Even if that one soul doesn't say anything to anyone else, but everyone else sees how we treat that one person, they will want to be part of what we're doing here, and they themselves will tell others about what we're doing when they see our love, our compassion, and care for one another. So, what should you do with this information? I asked myself that after I put all this together. I thought, okay, well, what do I want the brethren to do with it? First of all, don't have unrealistic expectations. Don't have unrealistic expectations of a work that you personally do or that you see the church do. Number two, do not make criticisms where you're not using the Bible in regard to growth. If you have a criticism, make sure it's biblically based and that it will hold up. For as I showed you earlier when I was talking about how we view, you know, a large church must be liberal, a small one must be sound, and so on. If we're not careful with that criticism, we'll criticize some churches and preachers in the Bible. And we don't want to do that, of course. Number three, develop a cooperative spirit that together we may save souls. And that's what it's about. Why has God left the church here on the earth? Why not, when you're baptized and you come up out of that water, why doesn't He just grab you then and take you up on into heaven? Because there's a work that He wants you to do here. And among those works would be working together with others to save souls. And of course, most of all, we need to save ourselves. For what good have I done if I save the world and I myself end up being cast off? I must save myself. Do you need to be saved tonight? And if you're not saved, you can do something about that tonight. I mean, I'm even talking to you if you're a Christian. If you've fallen away or you've stumbled bad enough that you think you need to be restored or you need to rededicate yourself, hey, we'd be glad to pray for you or do whatever we can to help you on the road to salvation. Please come forward now as we stand and sing.